I want to decipher the Oriental thoughts and secrets and to put an end to my bewilderment and self-alienation. I am a traveler, standing on the shore of thoughts. My aim, to pinpoint my lost identity. I am a traveler, walking on the road of human thoughts. My destination is the land of belief in oneself, in a bid to revive an identity which might no longer exist. It is an identity which, like a child's toy, is played with, but in a deadly way.
Some ignorant guys sent to the slaughterhouse of death every day thousands of innocent people because they are deeply buried in the marsh of their jejune ideas. In a way, there are two types of travels, a physical one, or going from one place to another, and a spiritual one, or transforming from one mood to another. Those embarking on the first type are many in number, and those embarking on the second type are much less. My travel is a mixture of both. Within the land and the sky, a travel in time to appreciate the ideas of an Eastern philosopher, namely Allama Muhammad Iqbal, the thinker, that if his thoughts were well understood, we would not witness the ignorant behaviors by Takfiri groups that are far from Islamic injunctions and humanity these days. Allama Iqbal wrote great mysteries in his books for his son, Javed Iqbal, and all others. As an old man, Javed knows it well whom his father was addressing. Javed talks to him like this.
Right now, I am 90 years old. You don't address people of my age. You address young people. You like them to believe what I say. I personally cannot fully understand you. I follow a path not wanted by you. Talk to me, who is 90 years old. You feel the elderly usually talk in a desperate way. You advise that one should not be desperate. The right man is hidden in you. Go on with your search. He will surely appear. You are saying the same thing. You have not visited me. I did my best. I searched for 90 years, but I did not find that right man. Where is he then? Tell me if you know.
I begin my journey right from here to the city of Sialkot, the birthplace of Iqbal. Perhaps in this travel, I would be able to show some special features of that righteous man. Today, Sialkot is a city in Punjab, Pakistan. The city, when Iqbal was born, was part of India.
Oh, you who are familiar with me, come with me to the childhood alleys. Tread on memory's pathway. Come with me to my intimate's alley. In my childhood home, on roofs quite stranger to all noises, may they be merrily remembered. The period of harmony with existence and excellence. The pleasant period of being with a companion, with all its liveliness. During all the year's generous moments, those alleys full of love, the splash of pure wafers.
ये वो घर है जहाँ अलामा इकबाल 9 नवंबर 1877 को सुबह 5
Here is the very room wherein Iqbal was born on the 9th of November 1877 at 5:14 a.m.
इस घर की इब्तिदा की 6 फरवरी 1861
The house here was built by his grandfather Sheikh Muhammad Rafiq. He was the first to occupy the house.
उसके बाद
On the 6th of February, 1861, he bought 3 small rooms and a house near here until Iqbal was born. Later, Iqbal's elder brother came here. The house has undergone no change since then.
Iqbal's ancestors were high-ranking Brahmins of Kashmir. They converted to Islam 500 years before Iqbal was born. The family was called Siparu, meaning educated. His father was a cloth dealer. Nur Muhammad's shop was frequented by great thinkers of Islamic sects. His mother, Imam Bibi, was also a religious woman. Iqbal had one brother and 4 sisters, all of them his senior.
Rooms were built before anything else in 1861. Iqbal's family prepared the first room for the wives. There, in that room, you see a cradle and a chair.
Encouraged by his father, Muhammad Iqbal learned the Quran from his very childhood in Hisamuddin Mosque of Kashmiris. Basic lessons were learned at home, as Iqbal says this was the best period of his lifetime, because under his father's support, his thinking foundations became established. Sialkot's graveyard tells years later, when his father died, the story of Iqbal's attachment.
So many times I have asked myself, what is existence? From where does it take root? What a secret it is that has attracted thinkers' attention. I could not find answers to those questions. Then, many years later, when my thoughts expanded, I traveled back to my childhood to find answers to my questions. There it was my father who decided on the shape a thing should take. Years later, when unknown things became clear to me, I came to understand Mir Hassan's teachings. He talked to me about the Book of Life, but he did not mention the book's title. A condition set before me by him was this: to learn new sciences Europeans learn. It is only then that you come to know what the value of the Book of Life is. He was quite right. Years later, with all my heart, I came to fully know the Book of Life. The Book of Life, the Holy Quran, whose wisdom is eternal and solid. It is an illustration for life secrets. Its power makes the unfaithful faithful. To mankind, it is the only message. The bearer of it will enjoy the mercy of both worlds. Bandits turn into leaders just through its memorization. They become pious just with the help of this very book. He whose heart's pulsation is a result of the book's warmth, his restless way finds comfort just as does a pearl. Should you want to live a Muslim life, only through the Quran is this possible.
Sialkot, a city in northeastern Punjab province, located at the foot of the snow-clad Kashmiri mountain. It was here, in this crowded city, where Allama Iqbal's first educational basis took root. Having received his first training by father and such a great teacher as Maulana Mir Hassan, The young Muhammad entered Scotch Mission School to start his official education therein. The school's premises, against passage of centuries, keeps the same shape as it used to have.
He finished his high school here in 1891. Then in 1893, he completed his 10th grade, and it was here where he finally ended his high school education in 1895 and got his high school diploma.
Having finished his high school in Sialkot, Muhammad Iqbal found the city too small to give him an opportunity to fly higher up in the sky. Muhammad was 18 when he finished his pre-university courses with honors, receiving 2 academic gold medals. Admitted on a scholarship, he left Sialkot for Lahore as advised by his teacher Mir Hassan. Lahore was a city southwest of his birthplace, 125 kilometers away from it. Then Muhammad Iqbal went to Punjab University, one of Pakistan's oldest universities, established in 1882 by the British ruler of the Indian subcontinent in Lahore. There, the instruction language was English, though some lessons were taught in Urdu. Young Iqbal of Sialkot went there to continue his education. Very soon, he got so famous throughout the world due to his thoughts and his Persian Urdu poems. Known as Iqbal Lahori, he was destined to get his BA and MA here and composed his earliest poems.
Undoubtedly, Iqbal is, for us in the world of Islam, a clear metaphor and a great name. Iqbal found an Islamic world, a special thought. At the present time, we are living in a place so blessed as it witnessed Iqbal, the learned, for 5 years. At a time when Iqbal arrived here from Sialkot to enroll for BA, the state university here had this one dormitory only. Iqbal lived here for 5 years. I mean, his presence here lasted about 5 years. He then enrolled for MA in philosophy. He completed his MA right here. In fact, spent both his BA and MA here in this dormitory, in this very dormitory.
Iqbal, as it seems to me, went through 2 periods in his life, a wisdom period and a love period.
During the time Iqbal was still in the subcontinent, and when he had not yet left for the West, he was naturally well acquainted with Western philosophy, had deeply studied Hinduism and Islamic thoughts.
At that time, Iqbal was quite familiar with Indian mysticism, and the traces of that school of thought can be found in his poems.
He studied in depth our religion, and with such a deep knowledge, he left for the West.
There was no ending to the stories of my restlessness and abandoning similar places. I was 28 when, recommended by my teacher, Sir Thomas Arnold, I left for Europe to continue my studies. Having a master's degree in philosophy, I had taught at the Oriental College, but going to England and starting study at Cambridge University for a doctorate in philosophy changed everything. Studying at Cambridge secured me opportunities to know better and more about Western philosophers. At the same time, I enrolled at the Faculty of Law to be able to get permission to act as attorney. The rest had no meaning to me. For that very year, I traveled to Hamburg, Germany, to do more research and finish my doctoral dissertation. For a whole year, I worked so hard to get fully familiar with philosophical foundations and to get my doctoral thesis finished. At that time, I met much of well-known philosophy teachers, such as the famous professor of philosophy, Max Neckrat, and the famous Orientalist, Reinhold Elin Nicholson.
He continued his university studies in Heidelberg, Germany, and became familiar with the thoughts and ideas of such philosophers as Nietzsche, Fichte, Schopenhauer, and the like. There were similarities between his thoughts and the thoughts of those learned men.
Iqbal continues to say that he was changing and thinking those days.
Interestingly enough, Iqbal was influenced by Western philosophers. He adopted their thoughts and opinions. He received ideas from them, but mixed them with his own to create an independent thought system and called it own philosophy.
Having received his Doctor of Philosophy, Iqbal returned at the age of 31 to Lahore. Never did he hesitate to return home, contrary to some students of that time. He left England quickly. He was then licensed to practice attorneyship and became a member of Lahore Bar Association. 3 years later, he became a lecturer in philosophy at Lahore University. He resigned after a while to exclusively practice as an attorney. This way, he was able to freely publish his thoughts. He continuously thought about finding a way to awaken Muslims taken captive by colonialism.
All my life has been coincident with the Indian subcontinent's darkest days. British colonialism and now World War I. India was dominated by colonialism since the 18th century. But as World War I began in August 1914, a new form of cruelty began to cover my land. Indians went to fight a war wherein they had played no role. They were killed and killed for people who themselves were the main factor in bringing ruin and destruction to the whole world. Description of troubles brought about by those calamities is actually impossible.
In 1910 and 1911, and after World War I, we see a number of liberation movements. Muslims rose against British and European colonizers. So Iqbal found himself on a well-defined route. He started composing revolutionary poems.
After World War I in 1918 and the fall of the Ottoman Empire, something had to be done quickly to save people of the tyranny imposed on them. I knew that a worldwide caliphate was no longer practicable. there was no agreement between Islamic unity and blind religious prejudice or extreme nationalistic ideas as promulgated by colonial powers. Unwillingly, I engaged in political activities. I tried to raise public awareness to bring about self-reliance.
Allama ran for Punjab Parliament election. As he said, he hated political activities and Muslims' needs forced him to enter the political arena. Consequently, he joined the Muslim League Party. He succeeded to become an MP for Punjab province for 3 years. During that time, he tried to solve Muslims' problems. Iqbal used to talk on such problems.
Allama Iqbal nurtured a wish for an independent Pakistan. He would say a new country, an Islamic country, would come into existence on the world map. The country's name, he would say, will be Pakistan. Iqbal did not give this name to a new country, but surely he had it as a Muslim country in mind.
During my lifetime, I liked those sleeping in the world of thought to wake up from their deep sleep. But sadly, the sleep is too deep. Therefore, I took refuge in the world of rhythmic words and meaningful poems to awaken the youths of this sorrowful nation in order to sail the craft of our thoughts to the shore of productivity. I was a young man when I found out that to weather horrible tempests and the enemy's lurking place, we had no way but recourse to the miracle of the last time. The Holy Quran, the book with miraculous words, which can be used as the best means to awaken thought and exalt the belief in self. The book is most succoring, particularly to the youth. I, who despair of the sages of old, have a word to say touching the day to come. Render my speech easy unto the young. Make my abyss for them attainable.
Iqbal's message is addressed only to the youth. He calls them Royal Falcons. As held by Iqbal, the Royal Falcon has five characteristics. Iqbal wants the youth to catch hold of Falcon's characteristics as much as possible. The five good attributes of the Royal Falcon, as seen by Iqbal, are flying high. So Iqbal wants the youth to fly high for sure. The second attribute is keen eyesight. The youth can fly high only if they have keen eyesight. Its third attribute is that it does not build a nest, nor does it follow richness. The fourth attribute, it loves solitude, as it is a source of creativity. The last attribute, as told by Iqbal of the Royal Falcon, is it does not eat the prey hunted by others. Iqbal wants the youth to show these five attributes.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., You wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Economic recession and inflation, high cost of living and poor performance of the government all means that the British people are facing difficulties with their current living conditions. This has prompted labour unions, students, nurses and young people to go on strike against the current situation. The British protesters say it's all the result of more than a decade of Conservative rule, and the time has come for a change. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Forbes magazine has more for us. Britain's beleaguered health services face yet another blow as the country's main nursing union looks to have voted in favour of industrial action. The Royal College of Nursing asked its 300,000 members to strike over pay in a ballot that ended recently. Although official results have not yet been announced, sources have told several UK publications nurses have largely agreed to the industrial action. If a strike goes ahead, it will be the first ever walkout of its kind. The move would put extra pressure on already intensely overstretched health services, exacerbating twin crises in emergency and non-urgent care. As hospitals struggle to get on top of lengthy waiting lists, a strike would likely lead to further cancellations of appointments. But union leaders say nurses in emergency care would continue to work if industrial action goes ahead. This includes those working in life-preserving services like critical care, continuing therapeutic care, and urgent diagnostics. The Royal College of Nursing wants to strike over what it argues are inadequate pay rises offered by the government earlier this year. Union leaders argued the rising cost of living in the United Kingdom dwarfs the salary boosts offered to nurses who have endured extremely challenging working conditions throughout the pandemic. The government says that a nurse's average basic salary would rise from roughly £35,600 to £37,000 from March of this year. This is an increase of about 4%. But union leaders have asked for a much larger increase that takes into account soaring levels of inflation. They want a pay rise of 5% above inflation, which currently stands at around 13%. Union leaders say pay increases are needed not just to help nurses battle the cost of living crisis, but to make the overall workforce itself more resilient. Britain's hospitals are seriously understaffed, with tens of thousands of nursing vacancies currently unfilled. Other major health unions, including Unison, are also considering industrial action over pay. The Royal College of Nursing General Secretary and Chief Executive, Pat Cullen, said in a statement, "Patients are at great risk when there aren't enough nurses. Huge numbers of staff, both experienced and newer recruits, are deciding they cannot see a future in the nursing profession and that is not valued nor treated fairly. Our strike action will be as much for patients as it is for nurses. We have their support in doing this. As we begin industrial action, politicians in every part of the United Kingdom will be challenged to back their nursing staff and understand the strength of public support." The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story. Britain's University and College Union, UCU, said on Tuesday, 8th of November, over 70,000 university staff will go on strike action in the coming days over pay, working conditions and pensions. Britain's University and College Union, UCU, said the strikes will be held on 24th, 25th and 30th of November, with staff at 150 universities across the United Kingdom taking part in the walkouts. The University and College Union General Secretary Joe Grady said in a statement on the union's website, "Campuses across the United Kingdom about to experience strike action on a scale never seen before." Joe Grady noted, 70,000 staff will walk out and make clear they refuse to accept falling pay, cuts to pensions and insecure employment. "This is not a dispute about affordability. It is about choices. Vice chancellors are choosing to pay themselves hundreds of thousands of pounds whilst forcing our members onto low-paid and insecure contracts that leave some using food banks. They choose to hold billions in surpluses whilst slashing staff pensions." The strikes are expected to lead to the cancellation of lectures and disruption to courses for nearly 2.5 million university students. However, the union said disruption can be avoided if employers act fast and make improved offers. If they don't, strike action will escalate in the new year alongside a marking and assessment boycott. The University and College Union demands a pay rise due to the cost of living crisis, following the offer of a pay increase starting at 3% and an end to insecure contracts. The union also wants a reversal of cuts to sector pensions imposed this year, which it says will see the average member lose around 35% from future retirement income. The British newspaper The Guardian has more for us. According to the City Watchdog, which said a growing proportion of the UK's population is having trouble making ends meet, millions of people are also struggling to pay their bills. A survey by the Financial Conduct Authority, FCA, laid bare the impact of the cost of living crisis in Britain, saying about 1 in 4 or 24% of adults in the United Kingdom were either in financial difficulty or would fall into trouble if they suffered a financial shock. The Financial Conduct Authority, FCA, found that about 7.8 million people were finding it a heavy burden to keep up with their bills, an increase of about 2.5 million people since 2020, as wage growth failed to keep pace with soaring inflation, which is currently at a 40-year high, currently at 10.1%. Meanwhile, 4.2 million people had missed bills or loan payments in the 6 months before the survey took place, in the 4 months between February and June of this year. The financial challenges were concentrated in more deprived areas across the United Kingdom, with people in economically challenged regions roughly 7 times more likely to be in financial difficulty than their peers elsewhere. About 12% of people in the northeast of England and 10% in the northwest of England were struggling financially, compared with 6% of people in the southeast of England and in the southwest of England. The statistics were gathered as part of the FCA's Financial Lives Survey, which polled more than 19,000 people and will be published in full in early 2023. The government is believed to be considering raising benefits in line with wage growth of 5.5% rather than inflation, which would put further pressure on already struggling households. The Resolution Foundation think tank has said it would have stark consequences for families, with a single disabled adult on universal credit likely to lose £380, while a working single parent with one child would lose £478 a year. A working couple with 3 children would lose £978 a year. Sheldon Mills, a director overseeing consumer and competition issues at the Financial Conduct Authority, said, "Our research shows that people up and down the country are struggling to keep up with their bills. If you're facing financial difficulty, you do not need to struggle alone. There is free debt advice available, and we have told firms they must work with their customers to solve any problems with payments."
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini l-Islami dini wal-Ardam ghayru dini Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to deal with an important subject of hijab according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But let's listen to a short biography before we start our program.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasid, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Sheikh Javid, we are still talking about hijab and, you know, around this issue, and I'm going to start up this episode with this question. Would you tell our audience and shed some light on some of the Sharia guidelines or religious laws about the interactions with the opposite sex?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, it is permissible to interact with the opposite sex if it does not lead to something forbidden, to something haram, or to temptation, of course. And when it is not accompanied with lust or intention of seeking pleasure. And we know very well that sometimes this kind of interaction, an interaction with the opposite sex may lead to something haram, okay? If it is feared, if it is genuinely feared that the interaction with the opposite sex may cause either side or both the parties to get involved in a sinful act or to fall into a sin, of course, it's not permissible. So it's very important to be very careful and not to exceed the limits, not to express love or, you know, to flirt with the girl and to be flirtatious, you know, that's absolutely forbidden. Mm-hmm. So one has to observe the limits when interacting with the opposite gender, with men or women, of course, and the Sharia standards are very clear. One should guard himself or herself so as not to fall into a sin. And when it's feared that he or she might fall into a sin, then he should stay away, and she should stay away from the opposite sex.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you very much for that answer. And another question, somehow similar. What is the ruling or religious law on a girl walking with a young man in a university campus or a public place? and interacting with each other, talking about matters of study and general subjects, of course, without expressing love and affection toward each other.
Well, there is no problem in this kind of interaction if one abides by Sharia rules and Sharia standards. It's necessary for an individual to be careful about his religion or her religion. As I said, mm-hmm. chatting to a person or speaking to a person of the opposite gender leads sometimes to emotional attachment, which will assist Shaitan in fueling and inspiring one's carnal desire.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, one should always be on guard against falling into what is forbidden. You know, as I said, if it is likely, or if one fears that he might get tempted, then he should not interact with a person from the opposite gender.
Uh-huh, I see. Okay, thank you very much, Jobit. Let's take a short break, but we'll be back and continue our questions around hijab and the like, or the issues of the same nature, inshallah, after the break. Stay with us.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Jawid, our guest speaker, and the subject is still hijab and the like. Of course, we are asking questions regarding different issues like the interaction between the opposite sex and religious laws about them. Sheikh Jawid, I'm going to ask you this question about, again, interaction between the opposite sex. And the question is, what is the ruling on a young man's friendship with a girl, for example, in a university? If the Sharia rules and the legal criteria or religious criteria, such as not looking with lust, as you rightly mentioned before, or not touching, for example, and the same things, are taken care of. By friendship, I mean like they sit together, they talk together, they laugh, they sit at the same table in a restaurant, you know. So what's the religious law about their friendship?
That's a good question, and that's what we see normally in our day-to-day life, for example, in different places.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, many young women have no idea about Islamic instruction and Islamic teachings and Islamic laws. And therefore, they end up, you know, making friends with opposite gender. To be very frank, I would say that according to the religious authority, friendship between a man and a woman is not permissible, no matter where the friendship takes place and what the purpose of the friendship is. Maybe in a university campus, a girl might end up becoming the friend of a man. That's not permissible, because friendship usually it ends up in physical contact and maybe some kind of haram activity or intimacy or something like that. And therefore, friendship in any sense between two non-mahram is not allowed. So sitting, talking and laughing and joking, of course, these things are not allowed, because, you know, how can a man start laughing and joking and, you know, cracking jokes with a non-mahram woman when it's very much likely that the very act itself is not allowed, okay, let alone the consequences of this practice, because the two sides might start or might end up falling into a sin as a result of becoming friends.
Mm-hmm, I see. Sheikh Javid, another question somehow related. You know, we all know that in today's or modern world, there is more interaction between the opposite sexes, right? And yes, in some places, it's more than ever, and it's more than the other workplaces. For example, I'm talking about hospitals and banks, all right? So yes, what's the ruling on this kind of mixing between the sexes in these places?
Well, sometimes mixing is inevitable. Like when you go to public places, like, railway station, yes, you know, bus terminal and airport, you see men and women mixing up, you know, they want one, for example, people going to different directions, you know.
Right.
So that's inevitable. And also the position is the same with men and women working together in the same place, like a hospital, like banks, you know. Everyone is doing his or her own job without, you know, and everyone is confident that he's not going to fall into a sin. So everyone, as long as he is or she is busy doing his job or her job,
mm-hmm,
there's no objection to him or her. So when one is confident that he or she is not going to fall into a sin, there's no problem in such kind of mixing or blending, such kind of amalgamation.
Mm-hmm. Well, due to the nature of some of these works, as you already mentioned, like in the puzzle, for example, where men and women mix and spend more than 7 hours together, is it permissible for them to talk to the nurses, for example, doctors, for example, outside work, or laugh with them? You know, what is the extent of the legitimate relationship between them?
Well, talking is one thing and laughing is another. You know, talking to a non-mahram woman is not forbidden per se. Mm. It is permissible.
Yes.
You know, doctors talk to the nurses and nurse patients talk to the doctors, and that is a routine thing. That's something normal.
Mm-hmm.
It is actually forbidden for the conversation to be in a lustful manner and with the intention of seeking pleasure. The believer must know that Shaitan has pitfalls and traps to snare him, to put him into a sin, especially with regard to the relationship between a man and a woman and mixing. Of course, he should be very careful to avoid pitfalls of Shaitan and to make sure that that he will not fall into a sin as a result of being in the company of non-mahram men.
Mm-hmm.
If he guards himself, if he protects himself, and if he is confident that he will not fall into a sin, there is no objection to him.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Shavit. Thank you very much for listening to the program. Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun Malajam Ilaha Illahum Ghaffarun Jameelun Wahhabun Latifun Tawwabun Samiyun Basir Ilaha Illahum وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Chatline Ziran says it is.